guitar pickers in Nashville. And they can pick more notes than the number of ants on the Tennessee anthill. Yeah, there's 1,352 guitar cases in Nashville. And anyone that unpacks his guitar can play twice as better than I will. Yes, I was just 13, you might say I was a musical proverbial knee-high. When I heard a couple new sounding tunes on the tubes and they blasted me sky high. And the record man said, everyone is a Yellow Sun record from Nashville. And up north here ain't nobody buys them. And I said, but I will. And it was Nashville Cats, plain clean as country water. Nashville Cats, plain wild as Mountain Dew. Sensei's babies, Nashville Cats, get work before they're two. Well, there's 16,821 mothers from Nashville. All the friends play music and they ain't uptight, if one of the kids will. Because it's custom made for any mother's son to be a guitar picker in Nashville. And I sure am glad I got a chance to say a word about the music and the mothers from Nashville. And Nashville Cats play Queens Country Water. Nashville Cats play Wild's Mountain Dew. Nashville Cats been playing since they's babies. Nashville Cats get work before they're two. Pick it.
Thanks for tuning in to Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm Amanda, host of Reciprocity Radio, and you're listening, to Reciprocity Radio. This is a show about food, cooking, drinking, eating, recipes, history, culture, all of that stuff. And so I just started the show off with Nashville Cats by The Lovin' Spoonful, or I think that was possibly a cover. And then we heard Nashville Skyline Rag by Bob Dylan. And right now we're hearing Flying Lesson, Hot Chicken Number 1 by Yola Tango. But you can guess the theme of today's episode. And that is, I'm going to Nashville on Wednesday. And I am really excited to eat all the things and drink all the things and hear all the music. It's going to be really fun. I haven't gone on a road trip in a really long time. So in honor of that, I'm kind of doing a country-esque episode. And I'm going to talk about some classic foods that are famous in that area. I talked so much about myself on the show, obviously, because I really believe the connection with food is so personal and oftentimes emotional. And I was born in Oklahoma, and then I grew up in Florida, and I grew up going on these road trips from South Florida all the way down to Fort Myers, which is about like 3/4 of the way down of Florida, if you divided it into fours, all the way to Oklahoma. So I was old enough to remember them very well and remember the roads and remember the sights, know when we get through different borders like Arkansas and Georgia and everywhere. So I'm pretty excited to get out on the road on Wednesday and see some new things and eat some new things. And I've got a lot of really great recommendations from friends about things to do in Nashville. So it's going to be really fun, but I thought I'd talk about things relating to that since we're preparing to go and I'm getting excited. I also started today at work a podcast that I've been meaning to start for a while, and I think I'm going to save it mainly for the car on the way down, but it's called Cocaine and Rhinestones, I'm pretty sure, and it's a 20th century country history podcast, and it's great. I was really like immediately super drawn in and loved it. So I only got about halfway through the first episode, but I am really excited to keep going on that one. And I don't know if you've ever heard me on other shows or on MP Orchestra when we used to do that. I love to sing country. It's like one of my favorite things. I never thought that would happen to me, so I was pretty excited to like finally fall into that. It feels like a way of kind of connecting with my roots in a sense, even though I never really spent time in Oklahoma. So I mean, I did as a kid, but I didn't. I grew up there. Anyway, so in preparation for this trip, I've been doing a lot of research about different types of food to get and things to eat and what to see. And there's so many museums, so I'm going to play some country music today because I'm really excited. There's a Loretta Lynn Museum. I'm sorry, there's a Patsy Cline Museum. I'm sorry, Loretta Lynn is not from there. She's from the Smoky Mountains, as we all know, from Coal Miner's Daughter, a wonderful film. But there's a Willie Nelson Museum. There's a Johnny Cash Museum. There's a Patsy Cline Museum. There's the actual Country Music Hall of Fame. So I'm really excited to go down and drink whiskey and check out all this really cool memorabilia, and we're gonna try to go to Dollywood on the way back. So I'm gonna have a lot to report when I'm back. Hopefully next week I'll be having Aaron, who is new to the station, covering for me. I haven't heard back, but I'm really excited if that's that will work out. That'll be really fun. I love having guest hosts, so it's really great to have people jump in from the station and do their own thing with this topic because it's such a broad topic and you can have a lot of fun with it. And I've previously had VJ and Rosie Mystery as guest hosts. And you can find those episodes that they've done on my website, which is reciprocityradio.com. You can also find previous episodes I've done of the show. And you can find recipes I've written, things that I've tried, blog posts, history, all kinds of things. My computer itself is actually out of commission, so I haven't been able to update in a little bit, but I'm really excited to do that soon once I get that fixed. Anyway, in preparation for the trip, we watched Anthony Bourdain's Parts Unknown about Nashville, and I was so absolutely thrilled because he interviewed two of my favorite female musicians, Alice Mosshart of The Kills, and then of course Margot Price, and I just adore her, and I'm really excited to dig into her work on the way down. But she's a Nashville person, and they we got to watch Anthony eat with her and see her sing, and I just, oh man, I adore her. So I'm gonna play some Margaret Price and a couple other country tunes, and when we get back, we're gonna talk about hot chicken. We're gonna talk about the history of biscuits and the difference, because of course in England that means like a cookie or a cracker, and we're gonna talk about a bunch of stuff. So keep listening. This is Reciprocity Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Thanks for tuning in, and yeah, I'll catch you after this little music break.
Okay, take two.
I've never seen the inside of a bar room or listened to a jukebox all night long. But I see these are the things that bring you pleasure. So I'm gonna make some changes in our home. I've heard it said, if you can't beat them, join them. So if that's the way you've wanted me to be, I'll change if it takes that to make you happy. From now on you're gonna see a different me. Because you're good girls are gonna go bad. I'm gonna be the swinginest swinger you've ever had. If you like them painted up, powdered up, then you ought to be glad. Cause you're good girls are gonna go bad. I'll even learn to like the taste of whiskey. In fact, you'll hardly recognize your wife. I'll buy some brand new clothes and dress up fancy for my journey to the wilder side of life. Because you're good girls are gonna go bad. I'm gonna be the swinginest swinger you've ever had. If you like them painted up, powdered up, then you ought to be glad.
No good, I'm still lonely. Seems that I just can't forget my one and only. So there's just one thing left to do if I intend to sleep tonight. So put the bottle on the bar and let me do it upright. Please put the bottle on the bar where I can pet it, and take my address down before I forget it. I've got a feeling someone's gonna have to take me home this time. Cause I'm gonna sit here till I get her off of my mind. My baby's gone, gone, gone. And I'm alone, so, so alone. And I've got nothing else to lose. So bartender, pass the booze. Oh, buddy, now. Bottle on the bar where I can pet it, and take my address down before I forget it. I've got a feeling someone's gonna have to take me home this time. Cause I'm gonna sit here till I get her off of my mind. My baby's gone, gone. And I'm alone, so, so alone. And I've got nothing else to lose. So bartender, pass the booze. Please bartender, just pass the booze.
Just heard Ernest Tubb with Pass the Booze. Before that, Tammy Wynette with You're Good Girls, Gonna Go Bad. And before that, Margot Price with Hurtin' on the Bottle. I'm Amanda, this is Reciprocity Radio, and today I'm talking about Nashville because that's where I'm headed next week. I'm pretty psyched to get out and hit the road and eat some fun things and drink some fun things. And yeah, I'm just so excited. I really am. I'm hoping I can get some karaoke in down there because I love to sing country. It's something I never expected. But as I mentioned earlier, I'm Oklahoma born, and I guess I shouldn't be surprised. it suits my voice and I really love it. So I'm hoping we can get that in. I heard about this place. If you're listening and thinking about visiting Nashville, or maybe you live there, or any, I don't know if you've ever been there. I've heard about this place called Santa's Pub. It's a dive bar. And they have karaoke every single night, which sounds like truly my dream come true. If I could just walk in and have a single beer and sing like one song anytime I wanted at a bar around my neighborhood, I think I would just like, I would be fine. I would stop going to therapy. I mean, I probably wouldn't stop going to therapy, but it would help a lot. I always like to do karaoke as a sort of a process, an emotional process for me. It really helps to sing, I think. So I'm really excited to go to this music city. I can't wait. It's going to be a blast, and I'm going to get to go see museums about my heroes, and yeah, I'm just excited. Anyway, so Nashville, I don't know what everyone thinks when they think of that place, except for, you know, Belmont and music and a lot of working musicians. But something that's come up a ton is Hot Chicken. So we're definitely going to go to Hot Chicken down there. I've been told Hattie B's is the spot. I'm going to check that out and hopefully record a lot of the things that we're going to eat and try and get as many interviews as I can when I'm down there. But I'm going to read to you now a little bit about Hot Chicken and how it became a Nashville thing, where it's from. And this is from the Bitter Southerner website. And this is a really great site about Southern traditions, and they have really great shirts and just, it's awesome. So check them out. I'm pretty psyched. Also, sorry, I was like, I think I forgot to say something. I did. So I did start that Cocaine and Rhinestones podcast today, which obviously you can find in the Apple Store. And I'm really psyched because I love, you know, history, and I love to just basically, like, if I can learn as much as I can about an artist, I will. And Ernest Tubb was the first episode. And so we just heard Ernest Tubb playing Pass the Booze. It was already immediately fascinating. I think I only got like 20-30 minutes in to an hour long episode, and I already learned so much, which is amazing. But what I did learn about him is that he works in radio. He used to have a radio show down in Tennessee, and I think in Tennessee, sorry, I might have gotten the place wrong, but he used to be on a country radio station. The same place. Yeah, it's in Tennessee because it talked about the Grand Ole Opry. But Ernest Tubb, yeah, used to play a radio show 2 times a week before he hit the big time. And his voice actually didn't used to sound exactly like what you just heard. He had a tonsillitis surgery and never rested, and it permanently damaged his voice. So he ended up being this like deep voiced person. But initially, when he was trying to make it, he didn't sound like that at all because he wouldn't stop. And when he wasn't touring, he was doing this like radio gig for country radio down there. And I was just like, oh my gosh, immediately feeling a huge connection because, of course, I love radio so much, as I talked about in last week's episode. Anyway, let's talk about Hot Chicken. So again, this is from the Bitter Southerner, which is such a great website if you're interested in anything about the South, anything at all. They have great t-shirts too. Okay, Hot Chicken is on the list of must-try Southern foods in countless publications and websites. Restaurants in New York, Detroit, Cambridge, and even Australia advertise that they fry their chicken Nashville style. More than 12,000 people showed up for the 2014 4th of July Music City Hot Chicken Festival. The James Beard Foundation recently gave Prince's Chicken Shack an American Classic Award for inventing the dish. But although I'm a second generation... Oh, this is also... Sorry, I should say the author. It's written by Rachel L. Martin. Although I'm a second-generation Middle Tennessean, the daughter of a Nashville native, I've never eaten hot chicken or even heard of it. I had never eaten it or heard of it before I moved away for graduate school in 2005. I came back 8 years later to find a new Nashville that eats this food. The city is growing almost faster than developers can manage. Historic neighborhoods are being razed and renewed. Suburbs are expanding. Fields are being replaced by paved shopping paradises identical to those spreading across the nation. My friends have moved to the neighborhoods we grew up avoiding. They asked me to meet them for drinks or hot Southern cuisine in places I remember as industrial wastelands. And everyone was eating hot chicken, a food I didn't know. Embarrassed that I didn't know this food, everyone else loved, I turned to Google. The web was full of photographs of fried chicken slathered with hot sauce that somehow kept it crispy, served on a bed of white bread and topped with a pickle. Then, last summer, my friend Julie moved home. She called me. "What's hot chicken?" she asked. "Have we been eating our chicken wrong all these years?" I asked my dad if he'd ever had it. "Nope," he said, "but he taught school in the 70s, and he remembered that some of the black teachers carried their own bottles of hot sauce. Sometimes they'd prank him by spiking his cafeteria lunch." Was this the answer? Was hot chicken a part of a city's history that had been invisible to me as a white woman? I asked Denise, an older African-American woman in my church who was raised in the city. "Of course she didn't eat hot chicken," she said, shaking her head at me. "Hot chicken's what we ate in the neighborhood." I went to the downtown public library to do a very unscientific survey of what they had on hand. I sat in their second floor reading room, surrounded by stacks of cookbooks, just to see if I could find a recipe to prove that in Nashville we didn't choose our chicken style based on race. I walked away with several new ways to fry a chicken. One of them added some black pepper, but none of them made it spicy. Sure enough, I started investigating, and I discovered Denise was right. For almost 70 years, hot chicken was made and sold primarily in Nashville's black neighborhoods. I started to suspect the story of hot chicken could tell me something powerful about race relations in Nashville, especially as the city tries to figure out what it will be in the future. I hate it when people date everything Southern back to the Civil War, but in this case, that's where my story starts. That is when Nashville became a segregated city, a place where there were white neighborhoods and black neighborhoods and very little shared public space. Before the war, about 700 free black slaves lived in Nashville. Their houses were clustered in small enclaves, mostly on the northern side of the city, but there were over 3,200 enslaved people of color living in the city. Most of them could not choose where they lived. Many enslaved African Americans used the war to claim their freedom. They left their homes and moved to the edges of the Union camps. The places where the freed people lived became known as contraband camps. Some of these were for migrant communities following the soldiers as they campaigned. Others were permanent settlements where residents plotted streets, built wood cabins, and organized churches. Federal troops captured Nashville on February 9, 1862. In the first southern state capital to be taken, it is early capitulation meant that the city became a key Union base. African Americans from across Middle Tennessee fled there, and contraband camps sprouted up around the military installations perched on the eastern, western, and southern borders of Nashville. After the Civil War ended, the people living in Nashville's contraband camps had a choice: return to the places they had lived before the conflict, hoping to negotiate new contracts with the whites who once claimed to own them, or strike out for somewhere new, gambling that they would find more opportunity in the North or the West, or stay in Nashville, building a new life in the growing city. Many chose to remain. Between 1860 and 1870, African Americans grew from being 23 to 38% of the population. One of the largest Union camps had been Fort Gillem, north of downtown near where the free blacks lived before the war. When the Union Army pulled out, Fisk Free Colored School took over the grounds, rechartered at Fisk University in 1872, became a leading institution of African American higher education. The wagon road through the fort was renamed Jefferson Street. A prosperous black business district grew up along it, and houses popped up around it. Several other large African American neighborhoods developed around the former camps located in what is now known as East Nashville, just across from the Cumberland River from downtown. Like the Jefferson Street area, these were neighborhoods filled with professionals, business people, and skilled laborers. Another black neighborhood grew up a few blocks northwest of the state capital, known as Hell's Half Acre. It housed the poorest African Americans in the city. It had unpaved streets and no sewer system. The city's disinterest left the area open to trouble. It became known for saloons, prostitutes, and other vices. It also had some of Nashville's oldest black churches and schools. Over the last decade or so, the story of how hot chicken was invented has become a part of a local mythology, the sort of tale Nashville residents can recount with dramatic pauses and wry chuckles. It happened this way. Back in the 1930s, at the height of the Great Depression, there was a man named Thornton Prince. He was a handsome man, tall and good-looking. Beautiful wavy hair, his great-niece, Andre Prince Jeffries, tells me. He was a bit of a womanizer. He was totally a ladies' man, she laughs. He sure had plenty of women. Women handle cheating partners in all sorts of ways. Some look the other way, others walk out, if you even get even. One of Thornton's women got fed up with his philandering ways. He had stayed out all night and come home expecting breakfast. She wanted retribution. That morning, just like all other morning afters, she got up before him. And she didn't make him dry toast or gruel. Oh no, she made his favorite. She made fried chicken. Then she applied the spiciest items in her kitchen. No one knows what went into that first hot chicken. She couldn't run to the grocery store to get something, Jeffrey muses. By the time the bird was cooked, she was sure she had spiced it beyond edibility. As Thornton Prince took his first bite, she must have braced herself for his reaction. Would he curse? Whimper? Stomp out? But her plan backfired. He loved it. He took it to his brothers. They loved it too. The woman disappeared from his life, but her hot chicken lived on. The Prince brothers turned her idea into the barbecue chicken shack. We don't know who the lady was that was trying, Jeffrey says. All the old heads are gone on, but hey, we're still profiting from it, she pauses, so women are very important. Jeffrey's has an easy explanation for the chicken's popularity. My mother said, if you know people are going to talk, give them something to talk about. The chicken is not boring. You're going to talk about this chicken. Jeffries tells me this sitting on a bench at Prince's Chicken Shack, the business founded 8 decades ago. She is about 70, with a carefully applied makeup and a fair faucet flip, and a contagious laugh. She moves a little stiffly, but she's still the one who runs the restaurant. As we talk, she keeps a close eye on her employees, many of whom are either family members or longtime friends. I'm at Prince's on an early Thursday evening, so most folks are picking up to-go orders or for dinner. Customers file past our table. Some stop to share their own memories. They walk by us to the back of the restaurant where the plywood wall separates the dining room from the kitchen. A window has been cut out of the wall. A woman sits there ringing up orders. Occasionally, she yells a number and hands over a brown paper bag of food. The chicken's grease and sauce quickly saturate the paper, so most customers grab a white plastic bag off a nearby counter. A young man is stapling strands of yellow, white, and red Christmas lights around the window. Of course, few folks say that before there was Prince's Barbecue Chicken Shack, there was also a place called Bo's. But who wants to go mess with a good story? By the time Thornton Prince opened his restaurant, segregation governed Southern life. Reconstruction had offered some... I have to take a sip of water. I think I've been thinking about spicy food and now I'm getting a dry throat. If for some reason you're just tuning in, this is an article from the Bitter Southerner about hot chicken. By the time Thornton Prince had opened his restaurant, segregation governed Southern life. Reconstruction had seemed to offer African Americans new opportunities. Black men got the vote and a handful were elected. Schools opened, educating children and adults alike. People hoped for land ownership and fair wages. But the abandonment of the federal government and violent opposition by groups such as the Ku Klux Klan left white Southerners to redeem their communities. Jim Crow laws hardened the division between black and white folks, making inequality part of a legal code. Lynchings, riots, rapes, and other attacks terrorized black communities. Many people left the region, hoping Chicago or New York or Los Angeles would be more peaceful and profitable for them. Others fled the countryside for Nashville, the other cities of the Upper South. Jefferson Street gave black Nashvillians a place where they could shop, eat, learn, and work safely, and worship safely. Thanks to these new migrants, the area around Jefferson Street continued to grow and prosper. In 1912, the Tennessee Agricultural Industrial and Normal School, now Tennessee State University, moved there. The same year, the city built Hadley Park, the first park black or African Americans could use. Restaurants, music venues, and speakeasies opened. Country music dominated white Nashville's music scene, but Jefferson Street became an important haunt for jazz, blues, and jazz and blues musicians. The Ritz Theater let African Americans watch movies without having to climb into a segregated balcony. Motels and hotels gave travelers options. Similar districts grew up at the heart of black neighborhoods in East and North Nashville. The city developed a pyramid zoning code, which meant that the land was zoned according to perceived value. Property zoned for residential use was higher value, so it was protected from the incursion of commercial interests. Property zoned for commercial or industrial use could be used for single-family dwellings, but at any point a developer could come into the middle of the neighborhood and start building anything he or she desired. Most white neighborhoods were zoned as residential. African-American neighborhoods were zoned as commercial or for industrial properties. In 1949, the city administration claimed 93 acres in Hell's Half Acre. They justified it by saying that they would rid the city of vice. The plat included six historic African-American churches, a business district, schools, and other sites of community life. The city replaced the neighborhoods with state library and archives, a large office building, a six-lane parkway, terrace parking lots, and a green space. They announced that they would replace the rest of the neighborhood with planned municipal auditorium and a private development. Few provisions were made for the people who lost their homes. There was a view that Nashfield held some time that suggested that one of the major problems with downtowns was the people, said former mayor Bill Purcell, as he explains as we look out the window in his high-rise downtown office, that if you could eliminate the people, then the city would be successful. They banned vices. They banned activities that they felt were detrimental to civic life, and they banned residential living. Urban redevelopment accelerated over the next several decades, and it bore down upon other black neighborhoods around the city. In 1954, the Federal Housing Act offered to pay up to 90% of the cost of Nashville if Nashville would raise unwanted buildings and replace them with superhighways. The city planners cleared the edge east of Nashville for a new interstate. They emptied another 400 acres for warehousing and industrial use. Another highway was routed to Edgehill, a lower-income, predominantly minority community. Black leaders began to worry about the urban renewal would become the Negro removal. New suburban developments popped up just outside the city limits. The interstates proved to be effective walls between the new developments and the city centers. Neighborhood governance controlled who could buy the houses, and so these areas were up to 98% white. Nashville grew increasingly segregated. Over the past 80 years, Thornton Prince's hot chicken business has wandered through Black Nashville. The first barbecue chicken shack sat at the corner of Jefferson Street and 28th Avenue near Tennessee's A&I's campus and just down the street from Jefferson Street Missionary Baptist Church. From the beginning, the restaurant was an unusual place. It was not the Prince's primary source of income. Thornton had a farm. His brothers worked for the post office and other restaurants. It was just a little substitute to try to get over. Andre Jeffries tells me, to try and get some bills paid. Since they had other jobs, they opened the restaurant after their workday ended. They stayed open later than any other restaurant in town, midnight during the week and 4 a.m. on the weekends. That's one tradition I try to keep, being that open that late. It's grown on me. I'm a night owl now, says Jeffries. Because the restaurant was a late night place, Jeffries and her siblings didn't grow up eating there. My father would bring it home and put it on the stove on Saturday night. When we get up on Sunday morning and was ready to go to Sunday school and then to church, I'd always see the little greasy bag on the stove. Hey, we were tackling it because he wouldn't bring home more than one or two pieces, and that would make us mad. After a few years, Chicken Shack moved downtown into Hell's Half Acre and close to the Ryman Auditorium, home of the Grand Ole Opry in its heyday. When he drove down to the Opry on Saturday nights, he could smell something really wonderful but couldn't figure out where it was coming from, said Lori Morgan, the country singer and daughter of George Morgan, a country music hall of famer who was a regular at the Opry stage from the late 1940s into the early 1970s and is the author in the cookbook Around the Opry Table. One night, he tracked the smell of barbecue to the barbecue chicken shack. He loved the food and hours. Pretty soon, the opera stars were headed that way after every performance. Segregation complicated the restaurant's new popularity. The Princes needed a place to seat their white celebrity clientele without alienating their black customers. They constructed an ingenious compromise. They built a separate room for their white guests, but it was in the back of the building. Whites had to walk through the main dining room to the kitchen to reach it. It was quite a nice room. We sat out in front of these benches, Jeffrey said as he rubs the unpadded white booth that looks like a church pew I grew up sitting in. I don't know how old these benches are, but I remember when I was a child and I was almost 70. I am almost 70. Black people have never been segregated from Caucasians, she continues. Caucasians separated us. As far as segregation is concerned, that is a Caucasian problem. She claps her hands together and shakes her head. Have mercy. The barbecue chicken shack was in the middle of Hell's Acre urban renewal project. The Princess relocated. Their new space was too far from town. They moved again, choosing a block building on 17th and Charlotte in the heart of the black community. north of downtown. It's at just about where Crystal's is, says Jeffries. Desegregation was a two-edged sword for many African Americans. Racism severely limited their lives and opportunities. They had a poorer school system and fewer job options. They were prohibited from moving into the best neighborhoods. They were denied loans and mortgages. They were expected to treat whites with deference, and even if they were mistreated. Any challenge to this system was punished with violence. At the same time, segregation offered African Americans even more reason to develop separate businesses and community centers. Black schools, churches, and businesses became sites of resistance where the next generation learned about black heroes and black history. The barbecue chicken shack might not have lasted if it hadn't been for Foster within Nashville's black neighborhoods. In 1954, the United States Supreme Court ruled that public schools had to desegregate. They could have just announced the time frame for it, but instead the justice said desegregation had to happen at a deliberate speed. Many communities used that wishy-washy language to push desegregation off for years or even decades. In Nashville, a young black man named Robert Kelly walked past all-white East High School, over the Cumberland River, and through downtown to all-black Pearl School. All-black Pearl High School. His family filed a lawsuit in 1956, arguing the city should open East High to him. The Reverend Henry Maxwell filed a similar suit because his kids were bused from south of Nashville to the other side of the city, a 45-minute ride. To settle these cases, the courts announced that in the fall of 1957, Nashville's public schools would desegregate only one grade per year in what became known as the Nashville Plan. The school board gerrymandered the school district so that only about 100 black first graders were eligible, 9 enrolled. White segregation academies and white flight further undermined efforts to integrate schools. 7 years later, fewer than 800 black students were in formerly all-white schools. Black teachers and principals faced demotions or layoffs as the city consolidated the system. The next stage of Nashville's civil rights struggle happened in February 1960. A few weeks earlier, students in Greensboro, North Carolina, had sat at a downtown lunch counter and demanded service. Inspired by their example, students from Fisk, the American Baptist Theological Seminary, and Tennessee A&I organized similar protests in Nashville. Black shoppers boycotted downtown businesses. Local civil rights attorney Z. Alexander Luby headed up the team of lawyers defending the arrested students. His house was bombed in mid-April, though no one was injured. In response, several thousand protesters marched from Fisk to downtown. The mayor met them on the courthouse steps. Diane Nash, a Fisk University student, who would help found the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, demanded, "Mayor West, do you think it is wrong to discriminate against a person solely on the basis of their race and color?" "Yes," he replied. Then he added, "That's up to the store managers, of course." The Tennesseans left out of his auditorium and its coverage. The whites-only signs came down. Compared to many other cities, desegregation was relatively peaceful in Nashville, but this may have been because of the residential segregation and urban renewal already separated the races from each other. Official segregation may not have seemed as necessary when interstates and building codes had ensured blacks and whites could not live, study, or even eat and work together. When Thornton Prince died, his brother Will took over. His wife, Maud, ran the business when he passed. Prince's first real competition happened because the family had a falling out with their cook, Bolton Polk. In the late 1970s, he left to open his own place. He named it Columbo's Chicken Shack. He served his own version of hot chicken. He added his wife's chest pies and potato salad. This launched a new debate among generations of hot chicken devotees, which restaurant had the better food and who had the better hot chicken. The first Columbus was near Prince's in the same all-black community neighborhood off Charlotte Avenue. Polk eventually moved his business just across the river from downtown Nashville. That was where former Nashville Mayor Bill Purcell first encountered the dish. "As soon as I had this hot chicken, I knew it was like anything, unlike anything I'd ever had," he says to me. "It was one of the best things I'd ever eaten." By 1980, it was time for a new generation of Princes to take over the restaurant. Andre Prince Jeffries was recently divorced, mother of two. Her parents had been helping her raise her daughters. Her mother was dying of cancer. Her parents worried that Jeffries' job in the city government would not be enough for her to care for her children on her own. Great Aunt Maud decided Jeffries should take over Princess, and her mother told her to accept the offer. Jeffries renamed the restaurant. I took barbecue. I took out the barbecue because this was never barbecue, she says. She also decided it was time to relocate. When I took over, it seemed like every weekend we were getting robbed. In 1989, Prince's Chicken Shack moved to its current location in East Nashville. It's in a strip mall that gentrification hasn't touched. On one side, it is on one side of it, it's an entrepreneurial clothing. On the day I visited, a deep bass rhythm pumped through the air. The open door onto the street. Next to that is a customer-less Chinese restaurant and a nail salon. The parking lot is potholed, and when Princess is busy, guests bump their way up to an unpaved lot next door. The area is best known for prostitution and drug deals. You've got to earn the respect of the guys around here, Jeffrey says, shrugging. She talks about the memorabilia that used to be in the restaurant. Many pieces have been stolen, including photographs of her family, plaques and awards given to the restaurant, and a set of autographed plates from celebrities who frequented Prince's. Jeffrey says hope that the restaurant will move again, somewhere nicer and newer. We were supposed to move off 10th and Jefferson, but a lot of politics got involved, she said, sadly. A new baseball stadium was planned for the area. If I'd had it my way, we'd have a shack-type building, but upscale on the interior, with a big old potbelly stove in the center of it. My mother always said, if you have what people want, they will make their way to your door. You can tell that this is certainly not an upscale bird place. This is my little hole in the wall, but people have made their way here from all over the world. All over the world. Well, okay, I think I'm going to cut it off there because this is a very long article, but I'm very excited to try Nashville's hot chicken when I get down there next week. I'm leaving on Wednesday. I can't wait. I'm going to give you guys a couple more songs. You've been listening to Reciprocity Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn. I am Amanda. The piece I just read you was How Hot Chicken Really Happened by the Bitter Southerner website, which is authored by Rachel L. Martin. And that was a really wonderful study in the race politics and insane history of the city, all around, centered around chicken, a dish that now we get to celebrate and enjoy. Thank gosh it survived, and I can't wait to try it. Let me play you a few more tunes before I get out of here. And yeah, I'm gonna play some Merle Haggard, and I'll be right back.
Tonight your memory found me much too sober. Couldn't drink enough to keep you off my mind. Tonight the bottle let me down and let your memory come around. The one true friend I thought I'd found. Tonight the bottle let me down. Day. But the wine don't take effect the way it used to, and I'm hurting in an old familiar way. Tonight the bottle let me down. And let your memory friend I thought I'd found. Tonight the bottle let me down. Tonight the bottle let me down.
With I Want to Sing That Rock and Roll, and before that was Merle Haggard with The Bottle Let Me Down. I'm Amanda, host of Reciprocity Radio, here on Radio Free Brooklyn every Sunday. I do have a little tiny bit of housekeeping to do before I leave. I've got about 5 minutes left here. Let's talk about this. Radio Free Brooklyn is trying to get to Austin to present at South by Southwest in 2019, but we need help from our community of listeners. If you have a moment to spare, please help us get to the festival by going to radiofreebrooklyn.org/SXSW, or if you know South by Southwest, and you can vote for our proposal. It won't take more than a minute of your time, and you'll help us get there. We're going to do a radio panel. We'd really want to go, so please check that out, radiofreebrooklyn.org/SXSW. We also have something I'm so excited about. It's Teens After School Program. Our Teens Take the Mic. We're proud to announce that we've been partially funded to start an after-school program for local teens in 2019. However, our grant will only pay for so much, so we're still trying to raise some money. The after-school program will allow for teens from the Brooklyn area schools to learn about media and media making using a hands-on approach guided by our local professionals in our community that are currently working in both radio and journalism. Each participant will create their own radio show, which will air on Radio Free Brooklyn on a new dedicated stream. So I'm so excited. I am a former teacher of high schoolers in all ages. So I can't wait to see this happen, and I'm super excited to just hear all these young voices. I think it's so empowering to be able to do radio. So if you can, please check us out on radiofreebrooklyn.org/afterschool. I'm super excited for this to happen. And remember also that we are a 501c3 nonprofit. So if you donate, it is tax deductible. Please check us out on those two things. If you help us get to the panel, we'll be able to share our strategy and how we raised this station here from the basement of Bushwick into where we are now. And also, yeah, you can help some young voices get heard. So check us out, radiofreebrooklyn.org, after school, and South by Southwest. And you can find, oh, wow. So I talked about Nashville the whole show. I didn't get the biscuits, but I did a while back make biscuits from butter and buttermilk that I made from scratch. You can find that on my website, reciprocityradio.com. And yeah, thanks so much for tuning in. I will have some things to report back when I come back from Nashville in 2 weeks. Up next, we have The Far Reaches of Dub, hosted by Kinsound. It will take you on a journey through reggae and dub music from past to present and into the future. So please stay tuned for some really good tunes and keep listening to us. I'll see you in 2 weeks, and hopefully we'll be basically drooling about all the chicken that I've eaten in Nashville. So I'll see you then. Here is Willie Nelson. Enjoy.
Well, I gotta get drunk, and I sure do dread it, 'cause I know just what I'm gonna do. I start to spend my money, calling everybody honey, and wind up singing the blues. I spend my whole paycheck on some old wreck, and brother, I could name you a few. But I gotta get drunk, and I sure do dread it, 'cause I know just what I'm gonna do. Gotta get drunk, I can't stay sober. There's a lot of good people in town that like to hear me holler, see me spending my dollars, and I wouldn't think of letting them down. Well, there's a lot of doctors that tell me I better start to slowing it down, but there's more old drunks than they are old doctors, so I guess we better have another round. Well, now I gotta get drunk, I sure do dread it, 'cause I know just what I'm gonna do. I start to spend my money, calling everybody honey, and wind up singing the blues. I spend my whole paycheck on some old wreck, and brother,